You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Martin Lindstrom and Oxford University teamed up to carry out the largest neuromarketing study ever conducted. Their study sought to find out how our unconscious mind works when we're deciding what to buy, and the results are the subject of Mr. Lindstrom's latest book called Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. It's published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased that it has brought Martin Lindstrom back to the show today. Hi.
Hi there. Good to be here again.
So, because I'm sure many people don't remember, tell us what neuromarketing is.
Well, neuromarketing is, first of all, a very controversial topic. It is basically a marriage between science and marketing. So all the knowledge which has been established through many years in the scientific community is now starting to build a bridge into the marketing community.
Well, in the old days, they used to employ psychologists to help with marketing. Now we're using neuroscientists to do it?
Well, we're starting to do that. And it's basically biology is meant to be a point of discussion where, you would say that now we're beginning to think about what is happening in our subconscious mind. How do we not just ask people questions, but look into the mind to really figure out what it is all about? Because that's the way we build brands today.
But that's also something that I would imagine would make many people concerned, especially about the ethical aspects of something like this. We don't want to have hidden persuaders telling us, knowing how we think unconsciously and then motivating us to do something we might not want to do otherwise.
Definitely not. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book also to a broader public, because I wanted to raise the debate. Here's my point of view on it. Neuromarketing is almost like a hammer, and you can use it to hang up a beautiful painting, or you can use it to use it as a weapon. And my point of view on it is very simple. I think we have today reached a point where we know we cannot plant a buy-button in consumer's mind, and thank God for that. But we do also know that conventional research does not really work. You could just take a look at the polling. You could take a look at, 9 out of 10 of new product releases are failing. So something new needs to take place, and neuromarketing most likely is that new thing.
There are organizations like Commercial Alert that are particularly critical. Does that hurt people in the field?
I don't know. I actually am really thrilled to have them around because I think they create a balance. I think in one hand, we need to have a balance. And one of the big focuses I've had in this book is also to show that neuromarketing is not just used to persuade people to buy more. We can actually discover things which we'll never been able to discover before to make the good out of it.
So let's talk about the study. How did you carry it out?
Well, we conducted it using two different research techniques. One is called fMRI, which is probably the most sophisticated brain research technique.
That's using an MRI on the brain.
Yeah, that's right. And the F stands for functional. So basically, it's a small movie you're playing off the brain. And there you're using, basically, you're measuring the oxygen in the blood in the brain. The other technology used is based on EEG, and it's a very old, classic model. What's interesting about it is that we probably are the first in the world combining two different types of research techniques in order to find out what people are thinking and what they're feeling around brands.
What's SST technology?
SST is just a variation of EEG, and EEG is where you're measuring the electric signals coming out of the brain. It's just a variation of it, which is more modern, let me put it that way.
How many people did you wind up testing to come up with these results?
Well, we scanned 2,000 consumers across 5 countries, and that may not sound like a lot, but if you take a look at other neuromarketing studies, the largest study until I published my book was 65 people.
What did you find a certain consistency no matter where you tested, or were consumers different in the different places you tested them?
Consumers are very different but similar at the same time. It's very interesting.
Because we're all humans.
Yeah, exactly. We did some tests in Japan and in China. We were actually the first one ever to get special permission from the Chinese government to conduct this study. And we learned that consumers in China are much more looking at opportunities where people in Japan were much more restricted. So when we showed Microsoft television commercials, the fear factor was really high in China because those empty warehouses shown in those commercials, where people in Japan thought it was nice with a lot of space. So you actually see a lot of contrast around the world. However, that said, our brain is basically functioning the same way no matter where you are in the world.
My guest is Martin Lindstrom, and he's written a book called Biology, that's B-U-Y-ology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. It's published by Doubleday. Since we have come out of a very long presidential campaign in this country, let's look at political advertisements. What kinds of political ads are the most successful in persuading people?
Well, I hate to tell you this, but I would say the Daisy commercial when Johnson from the Democrats were winning the election was probably one of the most successful ads ever. It was also one of the most scary ads. You probably remember it, where the countdown was for the A-bomb. That one was playing a lot on fear, and we later on saw in 2004 for the Republican win for W. Bush that there was a similar commercial, this time showing wolves indicating the terrorists coming over the borders. Well, guess what? When brains were scanned from both sides, exactly the same fear centers was activated, and basically they had exactly the same mechanisms or reactions in the brain. So commercials in general for politicians over the histories, over the years, has shown to work when fear has been the main target there.
So now political campaigns are using fMRIs and SST technology?
Not as far as I'm aware of in this country, but it is happening, starting to happen in other countries. Let me put it this way. First of all, I would claim that within the next election, the 2012 election, I'm pretty sure that polling is going to include fMRI or other types of scanning technologies. But I also think the reality is that politicians, on one hand, would love to do this because, we talked a lot about swing voters, and right now, the swing voters are 7% in this country. I think the reality is that we really want to understand how do we persuade those guys to change their opinions. But the problem we have here is that you can't do that using conventional research. So most politicians would be very eager to use the technology. However, the PR or the press backslash in order to, which will happen as a reflection of using it, may be too dramatic for them to basically justify doing it.
People often say that they're turned off by negative mudslinging campaign ads, but what do our brains tell us about that? Because a lot of negative campaigns have worked, haven't they?
They have. And I will say unfortunately, because the reality today is that fear is the main drive in our life. If you are fearful of your survival, if you can pay your debt, if you can pay your rent or the school fees, that is driving your whole life. So when politicians are appealing to fear, we do know today that it works more than anything else.
Were you surprised that Barack Obama's 30-minute infomercial a week before the election drew such a big audience?
No, I was not surprised about it because he was breaking almost history by doing that. And I think people were curious to see how do you run an infomercial for 30 minutes? What does he say there? I think, however, people were surprised about the content because the content was very much showing families and individuals in order to mirror the ordinary public's image towards Obama. Because the trick he used in principle was to say there's certain audiences we can't get hold of. Let's show them that I'm actually appealing to them as well. So he used people to reach out to other of his voters, and he did it very well. I was not surprised about him doing it, and I was not surprised about the high response rate there was. If it works or not, it's going to be another question. I think it works a little bit, but if it works to that degree that he is going to turn around enormous numbers of voters to his side, is still slightly undoubtful.
Consumers have been concerned for years about subliminal messages and they're being coerced by hidden persuaders. That really doesn't happen, does it? But there are other alternate versions of the same sort of thing.
Well, you probably remember when, back in 1956, where it was invented, where there was supposedly a picture of a Coca-Cola bottle in 1/3,000 flash of a second in the cinema, and supposedly people were rushing to the cinemas or to the counters and later on buying the Cokes. Later on, it was basically admitted by the founder of this idea that it was just fake. It was banned in 1956 across the world, subliminal advertising, and in biology we probably are the first to prove that it works and it exists. And in fact, it takes place every second. And we did that by doing a study on cigarette smoking. One of the things I've been surprised about over many years is that we actually are smoking more, not less. In fact, people are smoking 13% more across the world over the last 3 years.
Despite all of the health warnings and the things on the cigarette packs.
Exactly, and despite the fact that you can't smoke indoor, and despite the fact that cigarette advertising is banned. So I wanted to find out what is it which are making people smoke more. There's two things we discovered which I felt was interesting. The first thing was the health warnings on the cigarette packs. Now, normally you would think they at least have some strength in order to make people quit smoking. Well, guess what? The total opposite was the case. When people saw the warning disclaimers, in fact, they wanted to smoke up even more.
It was almost like daring them to smoke?
No. What happens is that, particularly in Europe, but also here in the US, you have a written warning disclaimer. And actually, people don't read them anymore. They just see a piece of graphics. And then 7 seconds or 10 seconds later, you lit up your cigarette and you get some nicotine. And over time, those two actions are linked together. It's the Pavlov's effect all over again. It means that in the end of the day, people actually smoke more, not less.
I'm actually embarrassed to admit that when I smoked and people would tell me that it was something dangerous, I'd say, don't get me nervous because I'll just reach for another cigarette. I was joking around, although I think it was a stupid joke, but it turns out that I was onto something.
You were onto something. And actually in Australia and Canada, where they have what we call picture-based health warnings, where you have nasty pictures of legs and limbs cut off because of smoking.
Running ads like that in the United States as
Yeah,
well.
You're starting to
bad
get
lungs. And
yeah, exactly. But now they're just putting on the cigarette pack, literally. I actually overheard a young guy in the supermarket saying, give me two lungs and one half leg.
Ugh.
So that's a reflection of it. People are making jokes out of it in order to survive.
So advertising doesn't always work the way we expect it to. What would be a better way to get people to quit smoking?
Well, the work we're working on, and I work with lots of anti-smoking organizations around the world in order to take my knowledge from science and from marketing and basically reverse it to make people buy less than more in this case. Well, we want to detach the Pavlov's effect. So in principle, instead of having the same warning disclaimer on the cigarette pack, we're now making a random concept instead, where everything is changing all the time. The illustrations are changing. Everything is changing. And that actually helps us in order to really make this become powerful.
Because people will notice something that's different each time.
Yes, and then they will actually act on it.
My guest is Martin Lindstrom, one of the world's most respected marketing gurus. He has been featured in most of the major publications, Washington Post, USA Today, Fast Company. He has been here before, and now he's talking about his book, Biology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy, with a foreword by Paco Underhill. It's published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later in this hour, we'll take a look at the extravagant life and dramatic death of the great architect Stanford White. We'll also hear from Israeli novelist Michal Govrin, and then Larry Ubel will answer your home repair questions. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Martin Lindstrom, who's written a book called Buyology, Buy-Ology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy, published by Doubleday. Martin, you mentioned earlier that the subliminal message in the movie was supposedly of a bottle of Coke, and we were supposed to then feel compelled to go and buy Coke. But hasn't something like that actually been employed on a very popular television show, American Idol?
Well, yes and no. I would not say they're using subliminal advertising as much. But no, first of all, let's define what it is. Subliminal advertising is where you are affected by a message without being aware of it.
Because it's flashed into our brain so quickly.
Well, that is one method. Another method is actually to show indirect signals. And I'll tell you a story which is very much telling you what this concept is all about. The Coca-Cola bottle was invented in 1915, and as it was designed, the briefing was to develop a bottle which is so smart that if you smash it on the floor and it breaks into thousands of pieces of glass, you can still pick up one piece of glass and recognize the brand. Isn't that cute? Now, what I work with is a theory called smash your brand. And in principle, that's very simple. It's to say, Do you own a color, a sound, a shape, a smell? And does that indicate who you are? So if you take an iPod, for example, and you look at the front, you can't find the logo. We don't need that. Just the earplugs, the white earplugs in itself is actually telling the whole story. And that is what we're talking about here. We actually did another experiment where we looked at movies and where we placed a McDonald's drive-in roof as a shadow in the background of the movie. And there's no sign, it's no nothing. And we could actually see that people got more hungry when they saw the shape of a roof. And that is, in principle, a concept of subliminal advertising. Now, to come back to your American Idol concept, we tested this show and we spent a lot of time on finding out, does product placement in a show like American Idol work? And here's the answer, no. Yes and no, because first of all, we did see that Coca-Cola is actually doing a pretty good job. They have the Red Room and people actually remember it after we were scanning their brains and after they saw the show.
Because in American Idol, the judges were all sipping from Cokes during the show.
They were, and they're also doing remarks on it. But most importantly, Coca-Cola was part of a storyline and the brand was helping the storyline to actually become relevant. Because the, you know, after the show or during the show, the singers went into the Red Room where they relaxed, and the Red Room simply became a term. So in people's brains, people were actually saying to themselves, that's irrelevant, I like that, it fits into the story. The same was the case with AT&T, which when we do the test was singular, and we actually, no, when you're doing your voting, you're using no AT&T, and that made sense in consumers' brain. The problem we had was Ford, because Ford is a car, as you know, and does a car have to do with a singer contest here? And basically what we saw happen there was that the awareness of what we call the brand equity before the show started up and the brand equity after was substantially lower. People literally deleted the Ford brand in the brain.
But we've seen the product placement of cars in movies and television shows for many years. In fact, in some cases, I remember one TV show, they only allowed the competitors' cars to crash, and then all of the good guys drove the brand that was, I guess, was the sponsor or at least was paying to have the product placement. I've always wondered whether that really had much of an impact. I've never really thought, oh, gee, because they drive a certain brand of car on this TV show, then I'm going to go out and buy it.
Well, you're right, because the fact is, if the brand does not play an active role and an important role in that particular movie, our brain deletes it. Why does it do it? Because we cannot cope with all this information. So instead of trying to remember everything, it says, this is relevant, this is not relevant. You know, I saw a movie the other day with Sylvester Stallone. It was one of those bored moments. There was 104 product placements in it. That's in average an ad every minute, and I didn't even receive money for watching it. You know, that's an absolutely waste of money. And so I think the reality,
because people aren't going to go out and buy any of those products?
People are not going to remember it. In fact, we can see from our study now the brands are deleted from the brain, in principle, from the memory.
But that didn't work with E.T. Is it because Reese's Pieces were part of the movie's plot or because people happened to be charmed by that part of the plot?
Well, actually both, but in particular the first point, that it was part of the plot. And you could see that, you know, without the Reese's, that story would not have been as perfect as it was. And you'd also saw that with the sales. It went up dramatically. The same it did when Marlon Brando was throwing the T-shirt, and suddenly the T-shirt sales plummeted in whole North America as a reflection of that. So he was persuaded to come back and put on a T-shirt in the next movie. So when it's part of a storyline, it makes sense. The problem is that 99% of all product placement and sponsorships, for that sake, is basically not part of a storyline.
So they're just wasting their money.
They are.
Do they know that?
Well, you know, I'm pretty sure I'll get a lot of enemies now. But you have to remember, the fact is that when we ask people, they may say they remember it because they're sitting in focus groups and don't want to look dumb. But when we look into the brain and we look at what the brand equity is, then we actually get the truth quite often. And that's where we see the scary results. And this is the first time ever anyone is questioning anything like this. So, yeah, I would say they're not aware of it, but they certainly are now.
What are somatic markers?
Somatic markers is developed by a professor from Portugal, Antonio Damasco, and he developed the concept many years ago. Just to explain it in a short way, one of my friends through life has always been scared of, you know, going on escalators, and I always joked around with it. I thought it was so stupid. He's same age as me, and one day I said to him after I wrote the biology, I said to him, "Listen, is that a somatic marker? And he said, gee, it actually is. Because when he was 6 years old, he saw a little girl have her whole foot swallowed by the teeth of those escalator steps. And that created a mark in his brain, which was so dramatic that he never dared to go back again. That is a somatic marker. And now we're seeing somatic markers in that whole term being used when we're building brands.
Because just as you can come up with a negative experience, like what happened with that escalator, you can also build a positive somatic marker?
You can, and not only that, you can also, you know, create a shortcut to a behavior. So in principle, it's almost like when you have your computer at home, you do a shortcut, and then you act to do something. You can actually do the same with consumers.
Well, the manufacturers want us to develop some brand loyalty, and as I understand it, that turns out to be a generational thing. Some demographics are much more likely to develop a sense of brand loyalty than others.
That's true. And brand loyalty comes from many factors. You know, one of the part of the studies we did was to look into religion. And what we did was to scan people belonging to the faith of Christianity. And we then exposed them for all sorts of iconic messages within that faith. We then recruited people which were huge fans of Apples and Harley Davidson and Hello Kitty, that type of thing. And what we realized here was that, first of all, almost the same regions in the brains were activated, which were really interesting. But what we also learned was that people somehow felt much more engaged when things were based on elements which we saw from religion, for example, rituals.
So is that why logos can be effective?
Well, logos are not that effective anymore, I'm sorry to say. We actually have learned that the total opposite is the case. The smaller, or if there's even no logo, it actually works better. I'll tell you a story about that. We actually did a fake billboard in Los Angeles. It was for a major cigarette brand, where we displayed a picture of a cowboy looking over the field. Then we asked people to pass by, no logos on it. We then created a second billboard, exactly the same as the first, but with a logo on. When we scanned consumers' brains to look into the craving spots, or what we call the nucleus accumbens, we had to realize that the billboard without the logo had double the effect than the billboard with the logo.
But people immediately associated with Marlboro, I suspect, because Marlboro has long created a connection between the cowboy and its brand.
They have established over time a lot of reference points, but the fact was, when you didn't see the logo, people's guards went down. They felt they made up their mind. It was almost like the intuition was talking, whereas if they saw the logo, they were warned. It was like a warning disclaimer.
My guess is Martin Lindstrom has written a book called Buyology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. It's published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Superstitions are a part of every culture. How does advertising and marketing exploit superstitions to sell things?
What's happening now is that I think every brand is looking towards Apple, because Apple and Harley Davidson has done an amazing job in order to create fans.
But hasn't Apple also established a very recognizable logo?
Well,
I mean, you see that Apple on a computer and you immediately know that it's a unique brand.
Yeah, but if I removed the logo, you would still know it was the same brand, wouldn't you?
I don't know.
Well, ask most Apple fans out there. You know, take a look at the earplugs, the white earplugs. Apple was the only one to change the color from black to white. You know it's an Apple iPod when you see it. The fact today is with Apple, I was in Sydney about 5 weeks ago, and I was entering into the biggest Apple iStore opening in Australia's history. What's interesting was there was 4,000 people waiting in long line, all of them that wanted to get into the store, waiting for 48 hours. I met this young guy, his name was Matt, and I said to him, Matt, where are you from? He said, I'm from California. That's 16 hours flight, just so you know, to Australia. I said to him, so where do you come from before then? Well, he just flew in from Japan. He was just opening another store there. So I said to him, are you employed by Apple? He said, no. So what do you get out of this? He said to him, I get a free T-shirt. And I think this is very much a symbolic language of what is happening when you become an obsessed fan. That is so extreme that is the type of brand we're seeing sometimes around. And of course, a lot of brands would like to have fans who are that obsessed. And that almost comes into the whole superstitious type of behavior.
Well, didn't the Chinese government plan the Olympics around the number 8, which is a lucky number in China?
They did. And not only that, they also made sure that everything was 8. And there was no floors, which were 4th floor in the hotel, because 4th pronounced in Chinese is pronounced death. And yes, you will not be able to find fault anymore. It's funny because we're laughing about it in the Western world, but then we have Friday the 13th, and the numbers of traffic accidents in Britain went up 51% Friday the last 13th. So superstition exists here as well.
Beautiful people have been used in advertising for as long as advertising has been around. In more recent times, like the Calvin Klein ads, the beautiful people are barely dressed. Have those ads sold more jeans and more underwear? Is sex in advertising really effective these days?
The answer is no. And I know I'm going to make a lot of people upset one more time.
But they do get our attention, don't they?
They do.
Because at least the first time, they seem to be kind of scandalous. Have we become solely inured of seeing people lolling around looking like they've just had sex, that it no longer has any effect on
us? Well, that may have an effect on it too, but the main reason why is a little bit like fear, that we are, just to be very blunt here, placed on this planet Earth to reproduce each other. So sex is the main driver of our behavior. And because of that, when we're exposed for sex, we in fact are so overwhelmed in our brain that we forget the brand. And that's a bit of a problem. So it's controversy which is selling the brand. It is not the sex bit, if you get sense.
So when you do brain scans of people looking at those ads, what do you see?
Well, what we see is that they are so highly engaged with it that the whole brain is almost lighting up like Times Square. But you know, the reaction, though, is that when we look at if they have a reaction to a brand later on, if the awareness of the brand went up, or if they're, you know, almost buying the brand later on, we didn't see any reaction at all. In fact, they were almost like damned by so much attention to sex that they really didn't remember the effect on anything else.
So many of the things that are received wisdom when you're in the advertising business turn out to not be true?
Well, I would hate to say that, but that's actually the case. And there's many reasons why. First of all, you have to remember it's the first time ever now we actually can use science to understand what's going on in our mind. Until today, we're just asking questions. And we do know today that 85% of all the decisions you and I make every second is taking place in our subconscious mind. So branding and advertising are all about our subconscious mind. That's the first thing. I think the second thing to say around this is, we've been obsessed with logos. The reality, however, has been that branding is not a logo. It's actually everything around it. And, of course, there's no education around this, so people really have gone down that track. And then I would say that the media's picture has changed a lot. Today, you know, an average consumer in North America is exposed to 2 million television commercials through life. That's the same as watching 8 hours of television commercials 7 days a week for 6 years. So, of course, we can't remember so much. And that's the reason why a lot of the techniques which were used in the past simply is out of the window.
Well, at a certain point, we started seeing commercials that started off with a startling noise or a startling image just so that we'd pay attention.
Yeah, and in the end of the day, what's happening is that we just get ignored. We just get irritated, and we actually ban the brain of the brand from our brain instead. So that has the totally reverse effect. So I think what we can say and what we learned now is that it's indirect messages which have so much more influence. And we're seeing that from a lot of the experiments either done for the biology book, but also just done in general. There's a fascinating experiment which was conducted in retail stores where wine was displayed, French wine, Italian wine and American wine, and then they played music, American music, French music, Italian music. Now, when they played the Italian music, the sales of the Italian wine went up, you know, through 50% plus. And when people were asked later on, why did you buy the Italian wine? People said, I don't know, I was just in an Italian mood somehow. So indirect messages seems to be much more, say, effectful. Again, hated or love it, because as a consumer, we need to be aware of it, which is one of the reasons why I write the book, because people really have never communicated this before to the public.
So how would that work if, I hate to think of myself as going back into the advertising business, but if I did, how would I apply this to running an ad campaign?
I think the first thing we're learning about now is that brands more and more will start to adapt the elements from religion in a systematic way. Again, hate it, I love it. We will see that brands will start to adapt the concept of rituals, for example. Let me ask you a question. Do you remember the Corona beer ritual, the Mexican beer ritual? The one where you squeeze a lime down the bottleneck? Do you know where it comes from?
Well, I always thought that it had nothing to do with beer, but Where does it come from?
Well, I'll give you three options. You have to guess. One, is it a ritual which are coming from Mexico in 1800 and something? B, is it a ritual which is established because there's so many bacteria in Mexico so you had to clean the bottleneck? Or C, is it because beer tastes so incredibly bad you had to put lime in it to get rid of the taste?
I'm ready to go with C because I've tasted Corona beer.
Well, it's actually D. It was supposedly invented by two bartenders in California to see how fast a ritual can spread around the world.
Really? They just did it as a test and then it became really...
They
proved a point.
It proved a point and it today is the number one importing beer into the United States because of the ritual. So the advertising industry is adapting more and more elements from the world of religion. We will see the logo will start to disappear and so forth.
So were you surprised by all the results that you discovered in doing this book?
I was shocked in some cases, both positively and negatively. I was shocked about the smoking experiments, and we've done a lot of our smoking experiments. I was also shocked about the fact that some brands really are wasting a lot of money, and I was shocked, most importantly, how important the subconscious mind actually is in making decisions.
And when people think that advertising agencies really know what they're doing, it's clear that at least half the time, they don't have the faintest clue.
Quite often, they wave in the dark, but no one can see them waiting.
Martin Lindstrom's book, with a foreword by Paco Underhill, is called Buyology, Truth and Lies About Why We Buy. It is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Pleasure.
Up next, a look at the extravagant life and sensationalistic murder of the great architect Stanford White. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.